Bloomberg delivers a surprise in Texas, a look at why the former New York mayor and billionaire is scoring so highly in a new survey. That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Texans don't often express an interest in doing things like they do it in California, but firefighters in Central Texas are eager to make an exception right now. We'll hear why. Amid record-setting violence in Mexico, reasons for optimism? A security expert in Mexico City says yes, and a Super Bowl win for Texas last night? Maybe more than many in the Lone Star State realize. Those stories and then some when the Texas Standard gets started, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on what many are calling the first real day of the 2020 election season. Of course, the campaigning's been going on for quite a while, but with voters in Iowa today picking among the Democratic candidates in the caucuses there, it's getting very real. And a quick look at the calendar shows just how real for Texans, exactly a month away from casting ballots themselves, Super Tuesday on March 3rd. Robert Garrett is State Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he's been scanning the political landscape to figure out what exactly is going on here in Texas. And that's a real puzzle there, Bob. What sort of numbers are you looking at to determine what the lay of the land is here?
Well, David, in our first Dallas Morning News UT Tyler poll, President Donald Trump runs ahead of all the major Democrats in Texas, but there's a big but. Both Joe Biden and Michael Bloomberg run close enough to be within the margin of error for our polls. So wow. Biden behind Trump 2 points, Bloomberg, who spent $24 million at least on ads in Texas, is behind Trump by 3 points.
I have to be honest, I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by Bloomberg's rapid rise. Blame it on the TV commercials? Is that what this is about?
I don't know what else you can blame it on. He is opening offices all over the state and hiring people, but TV is what moves numbers in a poll like this.
Yeah, and I say blame, of course, we're being a little cavalier with the use of the language. Credit the TV commercials, some might say, and it appears a lot of people might say that. So are we talking about in a head-to-head match-off? Is that the way that this is framed in this survey? Is that looking toward November?
As if the general election were today. Now, in the primary that you mentioned is a month away in Texas, Bernie Sanders is ahead of Bloomberg, and Bloomberg is actually tied for third in Texas with Democratic primary with Elizabeth Warren. But Biden widened his lead over Sanders in November when UT Tyler polled it. It was 28 for Biden, 19 for Sanders, which is 9 points. But in January, that widened to 17 points, Biden 35 to 18 over Sanders.
Let's turn our attention, if we can, to the U.S. Senate race. John Cornyn, the incumbent. What does your survey say about how that race is playing out, Bob?
Well, it's not really a race on the Republican side. John Cornyn has four unknown, lightly campaigning primary opponents. He's got 56%, and they're all in low single digits. However, 36% of our Republicans or independents-leaning Republican in our poll did not have a choice. So that's not great for Cornyn, nor was the job rating of only 38% approving to 30% disapproving, David.
Well, does that mean something good for the Democratic challengers? How do you read that?
They are even more unknown as a rule than Cornyn's opponents. There's only two of them, MJ Hager and Royce West, getting above 5 percentage points each in our poll. So, and we had 56% of Democrats or independents leaning Democratic who might vote in that primary saying they aren't sure. So far, Cornyn is being let off scot-free unless one of these Democrats can really become known.
This is a really interesting read, and we're going to link to it over at texasstandard.org. Bob Garrett is State Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Bob, great to talk with you again. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me, David.
Well, it's been a year since the Trump administration implemented its Migrant Protection Protocols, also known as MPP. That change in immigration policy forces asylum seekers to wait in Mexico as their cases unfold in U.S. immigration court. At least 56,000 people have been sent back to Mexico so far. Texas Public Radio's Rinaldo Leaños Jr. reports the asylum hearings for those migrants have been conducted largely in secret, and immigration rights activists are pushing for public access to those hearings.
A group of more than a dozen protesters have been demonstrating outside a big white tent on the banks of the Rio Grande in Brownsville. The tent serves as a pop-up immigration court bill to hear thousands of asylum hearings for migrants waiting in Mexico under the Migrant Protection Protocols.
Even the name is such a paradox, Migrant Protection Protocol.
Patty Brown is one of those protesters. She came here from Alaska to further shed light on how MPP is playing out here.
So here's the deal with Migrant Protection Protocol. Families have to live in nylon tents in places that are declared too dangerous for Americans to visit. How is that any form of protection?
The Trump administration says MPP weeds out false asylum claims and shortens wait times for migrants. Brown says to see the reality of MPP, all you need to do is look across the Rio Grande into Matamoros, Mexico. More than 2,500 men, women, and children are living there in squalid conditions in a tent encampment. These migrants are seeking protection in the U.S., waiting for their chance to appear in this court. This scene, a big white tent court on one side of the river and a growing tent encampment on the other side, is what MPP looks like here in these sister cities. Brown says she will continue to protest this for as long as it takes.
So this is expected to last until MPP is stopped?
This tent court is one of two the federal government is operating on the border. The other is in Laredo. Neither was accessible to the public when they opened. Erin Thorne Vela is a staff attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project. She says it took 5 months for the federal government to start allowing people in, and access is still very limited.
A fellow from the Texas Civil Rights Project attempted to enter the tent court with a piece of paper and a pen, and he was turned away. And so there's no sense of these rules when pushed. Guards at the facility were unable to articulate any sort of written policy or any law that prevented members of the public from doing something as simple as putting in pencil and paper to be able to make notations.
Thorne Vela says this doesn't happen in regular immigration court, where there is a tradition of asylum hearings being open to the public.
People are not being permitted in these tent court facilities for merits proceedings, which is when the entirety of a person's case is going to be put on trial.
Kenji Kazuka is a researcher with Human Rights First. He says sitting in on merits hearings at the tent immigration courts are important because that's where a judge hears the details of an asylum seeker's story.
Having members of the public present is a form of accountability. It's a way to ensure that due process is being done, and especially when someone is unrepresented, there may be no one who knows what's happened in that hearing if members of the public are excluded.
Immigration judges are not physically present at these tent courts. They speak to the migrants via teleconference from a different location. Kazuka says one of those places is the Fort Worth Adjudication Center.
No member of the public can go to the Fort Worth Adjudication Center to watch those hearings. So in those hearings with judges in that office building, no one can get in if they're not allowed to watch the hearings in the tent court.
While trying to access the tent immigration court in Brownsville earlier this month, TPR was barred from bringing in pen and paper to take notes and was told merits proceedings were closed, even if the asylum seeker gave permission. These and other restrictions have prevented migrants from having their loved ones in court. Ray Rodriguez is an asylum seeker from Cuba and recently had his final hearing.
When it was like 9 a.m., I took me to the where it was going to happen, and then I was shocked. There was in this little tiny room that was just space for the lawyer, me, and the court clerk. And then I had friends who were coming, and I knew then that, of course, that was not going to happen.
Rodriguez's friend, Felicia Rangel Zampanaro, tried to go to his hearing, but private security at the entrance of the tent court in Brownsville didn't let her in.
I don't know why Brownsville tent court is so different, but they don't abide by the U.S. laws for immigration court. I know that. So they gave us an option of staying and listening to other people's hearings or just leaving.
Immigration court operates under the Justice Department. TPR reached out to the Executive Office for Immigration Review for comment on issues with access to the tent courts and was referred to the Department of Homeland Security, which did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Those agencies did recently provide a tour of the other tent court facility in Laredo.
I have just left the Laredo tent facility behind me. after observing an immigration court individual merit asylum case.
Gregory Chen is the director of government relations for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. He recently posted a video on Twitter saying his organization was denied entry into a merits hearing, but the next day, that changed.
They told us that yesterday's decision was a mistake and that they would be providing access in the future. This kind of access in the future, they say, will have to be on an individual basis, and they will only provide it at this current point on the day of when we arrive at the facility.
On Wednesday, which marked 1 year since the rollout of MPP, TPR asked security guards at the entrance of the tent court in Brownsville if merit hearings were now open to the public. They said no, but a supervisor later clarified that they are open, but only if someone gets permission from the asylum seeker, their lawyer, if they have one, and the immigration judge. On top of that, there must also be available space in the courtroom. Immigrant rights activists say the lack of clear guidelines on public access to the MPP tent courts ensures that the public will not know what's being done in their name. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Brownsville.
Let's find out what Texans are talking about on social media. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. The Iowa caucuses are tonight, and our friends and listeners in Texas are keeping a close eye on the Hawkeye State's first in the nation contest. Here are some of the reactions we're seeing out there on Facebook. Paul Lewis writes, "Somebody has to go first, and the caucus system provides a much more nuanced way for the candidates and the rest of us to identify what voters are thinking and feeling." Jen Wireman says she has mixed feelings. She writes, "The caucus system feels like true democracy for those able to attend, but it leaves out so many that can't physically make it there." And via Twitter, Rachel Zock writes that Iowa is not a representative microcosm of the nation, but it's small and easy for candidates to swarm. Texas, New York, and California should go first because we look like the nation as a whole. Feel like I've heard that argument somewhere before, David.
Yeah.
So obviously folks chiming in on the Iowa caucuses tonight, many watching for Bernie Sanders to see if he will indeed, as some polls have shown, pull out a win there.
They had a mess up with the poll
in Iowa. Newspaper.
So it kind of denied the media a certain narrative going into this race. And so it's going to be very, very interesting indeed to see what the outcome is. And I know a lot of folks can be following it right here on this very radio station. Hey, listen, we need to hear from you, Texas. Let us know what's making news in your part of the Lone Star State. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, one of 17 U.S. universities with a land grant, sea grant, and space grant designation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin-watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Nearly 10 years ago, destructive wildfires forced mass evacuations and destroyed thousands of homes near Austin. Today, the city's soaring growth is raising concerns that Austin remains ill-prepared for a wildfire outbreak. As the Texas Standard's Jill Ament reports, community leaders in the Texas capital city have taken some extraordinary steps to get better prepared, including seeking the advice and expertise of some folks with lots of experience in the matter, namely firefighters from California.
I don't think there's anybody here that would argue that this is not a fantastic view.
On a sunny and windy day last week, about 40 people crowd the top of a scenic hill country overlook in Austin. But they're not here for the view. This group of city and state leaders are listening as firefighters from California and Austin point out the cedar trees and brushland climbing up the incline. They also note the strong winds funneling up the overlook. Despite the spot's great views, it's a fire hazard. A potential wildfire could quickly travel up this slope through the trees and brush, threatening dozens of homes nearby.
I look at the continuous fuel that goes right up to the houses, and I'm like, ah, you know, that is, in the conditions that we've experienced, that is not good.
That's Dave Russell. He helped coordinate the firefighting response to California's most recent mega fires, including the Camp Fire in 2018. That's the one that destroyed the town of Paradise, California, and killed 85 people. After going over the risks at the Overlook, everyone climbs onto a charter bus. From there, the group travels to other densely populated neighborhoods near Lake Austin and Lake Travis.
The first thing that stuck out to me, and I'm from California, was there's already traffic.
That's retired California firefighter Todd Durham.
So if you cannot get people out of harm's way in a timely fashion on the roadways, what are you going to do to protect them?
Durham and Russell spent 2 days here touring some of Austin's most wildfire-prone areas. More than 60% of the city's homes and businesses are located in wildlands, making that fire risk one of the highest in the nation. The tour was put on by the Austin Firefighters Association. Bob Nix is the association president. He worries Austin's rapid growth in the city's risk areas, combined with climate change, will create a similar wildfire outbreak that happened around the Austin area nearly 10 years ago.
When we have sustained winds coming out of the north or west at 30 miles an hour for a couple days, which is kind of what we had during the 2011 fires, it's going to be bad.
The California firefighters say Austin should keep investing in wildfire response training for its firefighters. They also advise homeowners here to fireproof their homes by doing things like keeping dry leaves out of gutters or reducing flammable brush in yards. In Colorado and California, officials have approved housing codes requiring residents there to fireproof their homes. In those states, builders must use flame-resistant construction materials. They also have to build homes a certain distance from each other. Bob Nix with the Austin Firefighters Association wants Austin to do the same.
There's ways we can reduce our risk. We all have to know it's important. We all need to work together. We need to get on it.
Austin City Council member Jimmy Flanagan's district is largely in a high wildfire risk area.
It's not a question of do we now believe there is risk? And it's not even a question of do we now think we should do something? It is what is the best thing to do?
He also wants the city to approve some wildfire codes.
We got to figure out what we can require and what we can enforce. And state law and the state legislature doesn't always let cities do all the requirements and enforcement we wish. And so that, to me, is the thing I want to make sure we get right.
If Austin does adopt a set of wildfire codes, the city would be the first in Texas to do so. Reporting in Austin, I'm Jill Ament for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. This weekend, officials in China reported that the death toll for the Wuhan coronavirus has surpassed that of the severe acute respiratory syndrome or SARS outbreak of the early 2000s. As of Sunday, 361 people had died in China from this new novel coronavirus, the respiratory disease. Fears of this sickness have virtually halted the Chinese economy, the second largest in the world, sending out ripple effects on global markets, including the energy industry, with effects that we may well feel here on the home front. Here to tell us more, energy insider Matt Smith. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
So I think I might be able to guess some of these answers, but what does the coronavirus mean for Chinese demand and global demand growth when we're talking about energy?
Well, it's a big deal, David. As you mentioned there, they're the second largest economy in the world. They're the second largest consumer of oil. They're the leading country in terms of oil demand growth. And so the impact of this virus is going to be felt in a number of ways, really. So immediately there is that obvious lack of domestic demand over the coming months, mm-hmm. because of the extended closures of businesses and that. The second piece as well is due to lower travel. So we've already got US airlines such as United, Delta, American already cancelling flights to China for the next couple of months. And there are others too internationally as well, such as British Airways and Lufthansa. And so there's definitely an impact from an economic perspective, which is going to hit slowing demand growth as well.
What about U.S. oil production? I mean, is China a major consumer?
They produce just under 4 million barrels a day, and they consume about 13, 14 million barrels a day, something like that. Mm. And so they're much more reliant on imports than they are on their own domestic production there. But that could take a hit because of workers not being able to be involved in the industry. But the concern is that we could see, their domestic demand hit because of the refiners cutting back. But at the same time as well, one thing that we're seeing, you know, we track these global flows of crude and products. We're already seeing a material drop in the volume of jet fuel that is being moved around globally, because the impact is already being felt there. So it's no surprise that we've seen this price drop in terms of oil over the last month or so, preempting this demand drop that's coming.
But I'm wondering how this is going to play out for us in the Permian, because it may take a while, I suppose, for it to filter. But eventually, it seems to me, it will inevitably, right? I mean, this could have an impact on making production just uneconomic, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're in a situation here now where U.S. production growth is already slowing and is expected to continue to do so this year. And so what we're already seeing is producers cutting back, cutting their spending and trying to focus on efficiencies and productivity gains instead as they look to shore up their balance sheets. And so a drop of about 15% since the beginning of the year of that U.S. benchmark WTI price is going to have a detrimental impact on that production going forward.
And then there's the flip side, though, for consumers. I would imagine lower oil prices will translate to cheaper gasoline at the pump?
Yes, there is that lag nature, and so it still has to work its way into prices. But on the Texas average at the pump, it was about $2.30 at the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. It's dropped down 15 cents now, and it should drop a little bit further to catch up with the drop that we've seen in oil prices.
And of course, that itself has further ripple effects. Matt Smith continues to track them as Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data, and he joins us every other week here on The Standard. Matt, always great to speak with you. Thanks so much.
You as well. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texans who want to cast a ballot in the March 3rd primary need to register to vote by today. As of last month, more than 16 million people were signed up to vote in the state. Charlie Bonner is with Move Texas, a nonpartisan nonprofit that works to engage young people in politics. He says it's critical for voters to make their voices heard in the presidential primary.
And in down ballot, there's all sorts of races that are going to decide the futures of our communities. And so I think it's really important for people to get registered today so they can add to that 16 million and get us closer and closer to full voter registration.
More information on how and where to register to vote is available at votetexas.gov. A military base in San Antonio is one of four in the U.S. that will house Americans returning from China who may need to be quarantined to see if they've contracted the coronavirus. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie reports.
At least 250 of an estimated 1,000 evacuees could be housed at Lackland while a two-week quarantine period plays out. Lackland tweeted that base personnel will not be directly in contact with the evacuees, and evacuees will not have access to any location other than where they're being housed. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg has released a statement saying, in part, "We've been told these individuals have no symptoms of the virus and pose no risk to our community." I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
And this morning, Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport became one of 11 around the country where flights carrying passengers from China will land. The Department of Homeland Security says sending the flights to select airports will make it easier to screen travelers for the coronavirus. Texas health officials say two more children have died from flu-related causes. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
One is a 16-year-old who was vaccinated. The other is a 10-year-old. It's unknown if that child had a current flu vaccination. Both are from the North Texas region, which has now seen about half the state's pediatric flu deaths. There have been deaths in other parts of the state, including South and Central Texas, as well as the Rio Grande Valley. During the last flu season, there was a total of 17 pediatric deaths in Texas. So far, there have already been 15 during the 2019-2020 flu season. That includes these two new deaths. Health officials are advising everyone to get the flu shot. I'm Sasha Kortner in Houston.
The University of Texas at Austin is getting $100 million over the next decade to help increase its graduation rates among students with the greatest financial need. The Michael and Susan Dell Foundation will be funding $20,000 awards for low-income students who qualify for federal Pell Grants. The program starting this fall will also provide students with laptops and tutoring. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. In 2013, the Texas legislature passed a law requiring all abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at hospitals within 30 miles of the clinics where they conduct the procedure. It also raised the standards of the facilities themselves to hospital-like levels. Well, as you may recall, the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the Texas law 3 years later, but last year NPR reported that the number of Texas clinics had dropped by almost half. How has that access to abortion services, or the relative lack thereof, affected women in Texas? New research by the Texas Policy Evaluation Project based at UT finds more women choosing self-managed abortions, that is, using drugs obtained without prescription or herbs to induce abortions. This study was led by Dr. Liza Fuentes, currently of the Guttmacher Institute. Dr. Fuentes, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about why this survey is happening now. What's behind the timing?
Well, in fact, this study was part of a larger group of studies that the Texas Policy Evaluation Project took on to evaluate a range of policies in Texas, including efforts to cut family planning funding and restrict abortion. And while this particular study about self-managed abortion doesn't directly evaluate the impact of HB2, the law that you mentioned, it provides a snapshot of the context around abortion access around that time.
Okay, so the time that we're talking about, give us that clear window. What time are we talking about?
So for this study, we surveyed 700 people seeking abortion care in Texas clinics in 2012. And then again in 2014. So we had two waves of the study. And we also conducted qualitative interviews with 18 Texas residents who self-managed their abortion at some point between 2009 and 2014. This was right around the time when a series of restrictive abortion laws were passed in Texas and family planning laws.
Okay, so what is the top line finding here?
What we really found was that about 7% of people who are seeking abortion care in Texas abortion clinics attempted to self-manage their abortion before coming to the clinic. They really gave four primary reasons, with the number one being that they couldn't afford to get to a clinic or pay for the procedure. They also mentioned that their local clinic had closed and a close friend or family member had recommended self-managing abortion. Others also mentioned wanting to avoid the stigma or shame of having an abortion. But really, the thread that tied all of this together was that people felt they couldn't afford the cost of abortion care.
How are you able to ascertain whether these abortions were self-induced or attempted? Was there a way to?
So what we found was that 7% of the 700 abortion patients that we surveyed said that they had done something to try to end their pregnancy on their own before coming to the clinic. That's where we get that number from. It's almost three times. In 2014, a national survey of abortion patients found that about 2.2% of abortion patients had attempted to do something. So we feel that this number is certainly higher, although this study was not meant to replicate the exact methodology of the national study. But what's important to draw from this is that some proportion of people who are pregnant are choosing to self-manage their abortion. So while it's not common, it's happening. And these results point to the need to ensure that people who may consider self-managing their abortion have information about what to expect, effective and ineffective methods, side effects, and where to go for support.
We began by talking about how the Texas legislature has been dealing with issues around women's reproductive rights. Is there a reason to believe that the numbers that you have found are correlated or directly related in a causal sense to Texas's legislative policies?
That's a good question. This study was not designed to directly evaluate the effects of the implementation of abortion policies or any other type of policies in Texas. But what we do know is that when we talked to women more in depth about their experiences and decisions to self-manage an abortion, many directly mentioned that an abortion clinic near them had closed and the distance to the next nearest clinic was out of reach for them in terms of cost and time. And what we do know is that for our study, people who self-managed their abortions did so because clinic care was out of reach for them financially. So regardless of what happened with the law, what we know is that when clinical care is not accessible, people may look for alternative ways to be able to get the care that they need.
Dr. Liza Fuentes is senior research scientist at the Guttmacher Institute, and she's been working with the Texas Policy Evaluation Project based at UT for this study. We're going to have a link to more information at texasstandard.org so you can dig a little deeper. Dr. Fuentes, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a network of more than 460 physicians who deliver cancer-fighting treatments and compassionate care to more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Last night was a big night for a young quarterback from East Texas.
Mahomes throws, pass, caught, Williams, touchdown! Kansas City jumps on top.
Joe Buck of Fox on the call there as Patrick Mahomes threw the go-ahead touchdown pass to give the Kansas City Chiefs their first Super Bowl win in 50 years. Football historians will note that KC has Texas to thank, not just for their quarterback, but also the team itself. They were founded in 1960 as the Dallas Texans and played there for three seasons until owner Lamar Hunt decided the town just wasn't big enough for two teams and ceded the city to some other club called the Cowboys. Of course, lots more recent history to break down with last night's big game in Miami. Here to talk it over with us is Darren Roberts. He's founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, always good to see you, sir.
Great to be with you.
This is a special team for you. I didn't realize, but I knew that you were an NFL coach, but you started part of that career right there in Kansas City. Is that right?
Yes, right in Kansas City. 2007 was when I started coaching, and really I was interning for the season. Slept at Arrowhead for 6 months on a twin blow-up mattress. I was just the guy they told to go get water and pizza. And, you know, so after 6 months of that, Herm Edwards, who was the head coach at the time, hired me on full-time. So I've done 2 years in Kansas City and was excited to see them come away with a win.
I've heard the culture described there as being very sort of upbeat, and even though they haven't had a Super Bowl victory in 50 years, there's a real sort of a hometown vibe there.
Yeah, this is a hungry fan base, right? I mean, Arrowhead is one of the loudest stadiums in the league. You know, they're always rivaling the Seattle Seahawks in terms of just the volume, and you can feel the electricity in the stadium. Mm-hmm. And this fan base has been wanting to get that Lombardi Trophy for a while now.
All right, let's put that aside. Did this game turn out the way that you thought it would?
You know, it did not. I thought Mahomes would find his rhythm sooner than he did. I mean, he seemed to be out of sync, and this is the third straight game in the playoffs that they've been down by two touchdowns. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, he's making bad throws through three quarters, but it just goes to show you this kid's resilient. You know, I'm an East Texas kid, grew up in Mount Pleasant, so White House, Texas, his home is only about 45 minutes away. Mm. But you really saw, you know, for a 24-year-old quarterback to show that sort of maturity and to really be able to bring his team the victory in the last quarter, I thought was remarkable.
You were talking about Pat Mahomes playing high school ball in White House. Goes on to Texas Tech before he's drafted by the Chiefs. When he was coming up, was he regarded as a prospect who could
pull off something like a Super Bowl victory?
You know, this guy was a two-way star. So many people don't know that he was drafted in the MLB, was a great baseball player.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Really good. You know, he's got a big arm, had a big arm in high school. I think people thought he would be talented. I think what people have really admired about him is just the way that he has developed as a leader. I mean, he is the leader of this team, and at such an early age, I just think it speaks a lot to the great high school coaches he had in White House and the college coaches at Texas Tech.
You know, and maybe I want to go back to a point that you were making a little bit earlier. It did seem like he was a little off his game, and I think some of the commentators on television were saying it's kind of hard to know what was he going for? What was he looking for there? You know, he seemed to be very opportunistic about the way he was playing that game last night.
Yeah, you know, the Super Bowl is an interesting game in that it's unlike any other game, not just in terms of the fanfare, but the schedule for an NFL player is completely off. So for 16 games in the regular season, you know exactly what time you have to be on the field. You have the same increments of time. Mm-hmm. Because there's a longer halftime for the Super Bowl and all of the hoopla before the game.
Oh, the timing's just really thrown off.
Timing gets thrown off. And a lot of the commentators, you know, mentioned that last night. So I attribute a little bit of that to being out of rhythm. You know, this is a young kid on a big stage, but let me tell you, he found his rhythm at the right time, and yeah. KC walks away with a win.
It's a young team too overall, yeah. You know,
yes.
And so they could have a whole lot more success ahead. But one of the things that I find fascinating about the way that you view sports is that you see it as more than just the game, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just about sports. So as you think about those leadership factors that came into play last night, what did you see as you sort of unfolding there?
You know, one of the big stories for me is Andy Reid. I mean, here's a guy
the coach
for 21 years. He set the record for having the most wins and not having won a Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
2012, his oldest son, Garrett Reid, died from a drug overdose during training camp. And so this is a guy that could have easily walked away from the game, and a lot of people would have understood that. But to watch him lead a team after he's lost a Super Bowl in Philadelphia, to watch him lead a team to a victory for a city that's been so hungry for it, I just think it speaks a lot to his character and resilience as well.
Boy, resilience, yeah. We would be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that some politics came into play.
Not in sports. Huh?
Well, early on, you know, the camera caught Beyonce and Jay-Z sitting down during the singing of the national anthem. And we've talked before about how Jay-Z partnered with the NFL and social justice initiatives. And, you know, I critics have said he's using the protest for profit. What do you take away from that move?
You know, I talk about this is not about sports, and there are so many layers here because Jay-Z was one of the early supporters of Colin Kaepernick. And so people were really surprised when Roc Nation signed this deal with the NFL to help them with, you know, their image and social justice mm-hmm, initiatives. Mm-hmm. I think it's tough to reconcile both wanting to support Colin Kaepernick in a substantive way.
Mm-hmm.
But also being on sort of the bankroll, you know, having business, a business deal with the NFL. And look, I'm hopeful that Jay-Z can help to enlighten a lot of the leaders within the NFL, can help to guide them in the right direction. There's a lot of improvement that the NFL needs to make as it relates to social justice and its embrace of players who take positions that may run counter to what the NFL believes. But, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce are getting a lot of flack for it. I'm not sure they care, but this story is not over for sure.
Darren Roberts is the founding director of the Center for Sports Leadership and Innovation at the University of Texas at Austin. Darren, good to see you again, sir. Thanks so much for stopping in.
Likewise. Thank you, Dave.
Well, you can continue to wear shorts for the next 6 weeks. That's the forecast from BK Bob, Punxsutawney Phil's more sensibly insulated cousin. The two aren't really related kids. One's a groundhog, the other's an armadillo. Then again, the idea of a groundhog predicting whether we're going to have an early spring's pretty preposterous, don't you think? BK Bob's been doing his thing since the first Armadillo Day 2012, and wouldn't you know it, no shadow Just as he predicted, temperatures unseasonably warm over the weekend. That'll change midweek, though. Strong cold front expected to blow through Tuesday night, bringing a 30-degree-plus temperature drop, rain and storms, possible ice and wintry mix in North Texas through the Panhandle and further west. But look, just keep those shorts handy because, well, because an armadillo says so. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. When Mexican President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador ended his first year in office, it ended up being a terrible year for public safety and deaths. In fact, 2019 was the deadliest year since the counting started in 1997, even surpassing the previous record of 33,000 murdered in 2018. But AMLO, as the president is known, still appears to enjoy the support of a majority of Mexicans. Indeed, one may wonder why, when it comes to crime, there remains a certain persistence of hope. Alejandro Hope is a security analyst based in Mexico City who's been writing about this very issue, reasons for optimism amidst a crime wave. He's also guest lecturer at the Woodrow Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. Senior Hope, welcome to the Texas Standard. We appreciate you taking time to speak with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We want to focus on three factors in particular, one of which is demographics. How do demographics contribute to a more hopeful prognosis in Mexico?
Well, Mexico is right now experiencing a youth bulge. The number of males between 15 and 29 is the largest cohort we have ever seen. That is likely to change over the next generation or so. Mexico is in a process of rapid aging. The birth rate has declined significantly over the past 40 years or so, which means that the number of young males will probably decline. If everything else remains constant, that in and by itself should lead to a reduction of crime. The ages where people are more prone to commit crimes are between 15 and 29, mm-hmm. and that is precisely the cohort that will decline in both absolute and relative terms in Mexico, the next generation.
But so, forgive me for interrupting, it's not just demographics here that you're pointing to. There's also the technology factor, right?
Yes, I mean, because, for instance, a large portion of the drug trade is likely to move online. We're already seeing it. People in the U.S. can connect with someone in China through the dark web, buy some fentanyl, pay with bitcoins, and get it delivered through DHL or UPS or whatever. That means that will reduce the distance between the producer and the final consumer, mm-hmm. will probably reduce the need for large-scale criminal structures that now dominate the drug trade.
But it's, forgive me yes. for interrupting again, it's not just that the technology would in a way curb criminal behavior. What it does is it seems to remove it from the streets, thereby making it less violent.
That is correct. A large portion of criminal activity will likely move online, which means that even if the size of the illicit markets remain the same, mm-hmm. They're likely to be less violent per dollar of income.
Well, while we're talking about technology, I suppose we should move on to a third point. Mexico now has massive amounts of data that it's gathered, and now comes the next step, and that's doing something with all that data.
That is correct. The quality of Mexican data about crime has improved massively over the past decade. We have one of the largest victimization surveys in the world, certainly the largest in Latin America. We are the only OECD country that publishes crime data on a monthly basis. That could lead potentially to much more evidence-based policymaking in the security sector, and that could lead to better results over the medium and long term. That is already starting to happen at the local level in some places. And that could that is a phenomenon that could extend and that could grow over the next generation as the power of data becomes much more apparent.
We're not talking about short-term answers here, right?
No, everything that can improve security in Mexico is a long-term factor. There are some things that can be done over the short term, particularly at the local level, but a broader improvement will probably need changes in structural factors, and that means that we have to wait for the long term.
And by long term, what are you thinking? I mean,
thinking 20 years.
20 years, but yep. You remain hopeful, and you think there's reason for hope.
Of course. That's my name.
Literally. Alejandro Hope, security analyst based in Mexico City. We'll link to his piece for El Universal at texasstandard.org. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wilt Dunbar joins us once again with the talk of Texas on this Monday. What are you seeing out there?
Super Bowl 54 in the talk of social media. No big surprise there. You know, it is kind of like the last, I don't know, it along with the Oscars, the sort of last, shared moment people get live on television in this age of streaming.
Yes, so that may be true. Yeah.
Lots of folks chiming in about it. Edward Eichinger saying that he watched the game and found it very exciting. Loved the ending. Kansas City Chiefs winning at the end with those two touchdowns. And Blanca Houston concurs, adding that she rooted for Kansas City QB Pat Mahomes, a nice kid from Tyler, Texas, as she calls him there. Blanca adds that the halftime performers Jennifer Lopez and Shakira were the perfect compliment for the Miami setting of Super Bowl 54. And Janice Hitchcock is chiming in about the commercial. She says, Bill Murray and a groundhog still make me laugh out loud 20 years after the original movie. Meanwhile, Gary Glass here asking the important question, can you OD on guacamole and chips? I don't know. Maybe we should send someone to Gary's house, make sure he's okay there. I'm pretty sure he is if he was able to leave that comment with us today. But obviously, but that Monday after the Super Bowl, kind of a rough one around the offices in many American cities, Texas cities included.
That's what I've, I understand. I don't think there's one kind of guacamole I have not OD'd on, however. That pea guacamole that the New York Times put out. I will never forget.
Never stop dunking on that one.
No, I am sorry. That's just the nastiest. Anyway.
You know, I saw an HEB tweet. Okay, this is totally getting off track here, but HEB had like a strange guacamole tweet. Didn't have peas. I forget what the offending substance was. I'm thinking HEB, though, because they had an HEB ad last night during the game, and I heard that it was so successful it crashed the app that they were directing
Eva
people
Longoria
to.
Eva Longoria was, absolutely.
Pitch person there for the San Antonio-based grocer. Well, we're here. Hearing also about, the Super Bowl of politics, you could call it, closing arguments in the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump.
Yep.
That happening right now, per this moment in time with you and me, David.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Brad Emmons.
You're safe there.
Yeah. Brad Emmons on our Facebook page. He says this about the trial. He says, most Americans have tuned out. Most give the giving the results a resounding meh, in his opinion. He doesn't see it boosting Trump nor crumbling the Republic. And he says, for the swing voters who matter most, I doubt this will factor much come November. Steve Safran is less sanguine about the situation. He says, what we've learned from this and from the Trump presidency as a whole is that the country many of us thought we knew doesn't exist. He goes on to say that this impeachment will only embolden Trump and his followers. Meanwhile, James Art Exum, he says that the presidency has been gaining strength over the other two branches of government in recent decades, and he asks that maybe this could be a sign that it's gone too far and could hopefully be a turning point where the powers rebalance between the branches.
Turning point? We'd love to hear what you think of that, Texas. You know what to do. You just reach out to us on social media, and Wells Dunbar would love to share your thoughts with the rest of the Lone Star State. But as it happens, we're out of time for the big broadcast. News continues over at texasstandard.org. And we'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.